You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today, I'm joined by Kimberly Fitzgerald, archaeologist for the City of Salem, Oregon, and Brees Edwards, historic preservation manager for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, to discuss the Oregon Mission Indian Manual Labor Training School archaeological project. Kimberly and Brees, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. So, Kimberly, I want to briefly start out with a little background on how the public archaeology project began, because this is the latest iteration of an ongoing effort to locate and study early contact period sites in the Salem area. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So our Historic Landmarks Commission has prioritized focusing on better understanding this early contact period. And it's been part of our research and documentation of six different Methodist mission stations in the Oregon country. So before it even became a territory, so in what is now Oregon and Washington. And I have some great news to share. We did a National Register MPD, multiple property document, which we just found out was listed by the keeper on the National Register.
Wow, so, great job.
I know,
great
job. You know how hard that is.
Yes.
So we actually started our archaeological excavations collaborating with the Grand Ronde, as well as with students from Willamette University, Portland State, even University of Oregon, and OSU to do the initial documentation and testing at the Jason Lee House site, which was also known as Mill Place. And that started in 2020, which, you know, what was going on that year?
Yeah.
I don't know. and then we shifted gears and did some testing at the Parsonage site, which is on the current Willamette Heritage Center site. And then this year is when we started in earnest on Willamette University's campus, which is where the 1842 mission school was located. And I want to give a big shout out to the Confederate Tribes of the Grand Ronde, because they've really helped us, especially this year, with pivoting from documenting all our paperwork and the site using only paper to using iPads. We were able to use LIDAR. They helped us, as they always have, with the ground penetrating radar. But one of the key things I'm really excited to learn more about is the sort of post-processing of the LIDAR. We uncovered a feature, which I believe is a subfloor, it's cobble, and we excavated across seven different 1x1 meter units. And so using that LIDAR to help us see in a 3D realm, I'll turn it over to Brees because he understands how to speak about it way more than I do, but we're very excited about that.
Yeah, and I think that is so awesome to use this tech. So, Brees, the Grand Ronde works closely with archaeologists across a large swath of the state. We get to consult with you and work with you quite often, which is wonderful. But this project is unique in that you were really embedded into this collaborative project in the field. So can you speak a little bit about how the access involvement is shaping the research, not only in bringing along all the fun tools and toys, but also just the way that you're thinking about this site and this kind of research project?
So Grand Ronde has been part of this project, this research work that the City of Salem and their partners have been working on, looking at those early days of interaction between Jason Lee and the tribes and the families of those tribes in the Willamette Valley for several years. Over that time, Grand Ronde has also been able to learn more about this, but we also have been looking at how do we make sure that this field, this discipline of archaeology carries forward in a way that is not just about learning about now, looking in the rear view of the past, but how do we make sure that all of that information that is gathered is about going forward? And so we've been looking at the role of modern technologies in fulfilling that. How do we take our mandate for advocate for the resource and maximize that with amazing tools that sit in front front of us today. So one thing that we've been looking at is how do we step into a digital world for recording detailed information, but not just make a digital form that would be the equivalent of what we had as a paper form and put it on a computer, but how do we utilize the camera capacity? How do we build a 3D model of those excavations as they're occurring so that we're building a live flow as it's occurring? And with holding this concept of minimize harm and damage through the archaeological process, we need to find a way to get the most information out of the smallest area. And digital platforms are really emerging as a way that we can achieve that. And so working with Kimberly this year in particular, we run through a lot of our own testing internally and found a partner that was willing to try this out in an active project and help us find where it breaks so that we can make this a better process.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and we're talking about recent excavations at the Oregon Mission Indian Manual Labor Training School Archaeological Project. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you're bringing all this really high-tech stuff to this project, but I want to talk a little bit about the site itself. So when people hear about schools, they mostly think positive educational opportunities, but that is not the story at the site. This wasn't just one of learning, but one where families sent their students there under duress and the students were mistreated. And so can you speak a little bit to how the archaeology is providing insight into the lives of the students and the ways that they survived and resisted, and perhaps adding to the important conversations about these types of institutions that once were present in these communities?
If I can give some background, and then I also want to point out when I turn it over to Brees that I see a lot of parallels with your work, Chelsea, with the Chinese diaspora and what the Grand Ronde is bringing to the table. And I want to emphasize how important it is to frame this research in a way so that we are seeing the indigenous people and how they were resilient in the face of all these challenges and how they used their agency. So I want to begin with that. And then I can just share that through our research, I discovered something that surprised me. I didn't know this, that the federal government was actually offering financial incentives to religious organizations to set up these schools. And their purpose was to have these religious organizations basically do the early work of the government to convert and quote unquote westernize indigenous people living within territories adjacent to the lands held by the United States at the time, which they wanted to expand to. So these policies were part of the larger efforts to remove the indigenous people from their native lands and assimilate them into American culture and, you know, just paving the way for your American settlers to populate these lands. And whether or not the Methodist missionaries stationed in the Oregon country were fully aware of it or not, they did play a key role in facilitating this government's policy of removing the indigenous people from their traditional homelands. And so the short version of this school, it was only open for 2 years from 1842 to 1844. And at the time that it closed, the Methodist board had sent out an inspector, for lack of a better word, Reverend George Gary. And he investigated multiple reports and complaints regarding the mission. And when he saw the conditions at the school, he shut it down immediately and then made recommendations and worked to close the other stations as well. And then, again, I want to turn it over to Brees now so he can tell a little bit more the fuller story of how the Indigenous children and the people then used this experience in their future adult lives.
Thank you. Absolutely. And I really think your point of the role that these kind of early steps of colonial actions in Western Oregon were being funded through essentially third parties by the federal government is we don't hear enough about that. And that is a part of what was the lived experience. The other thing for context is we think children at schools like this through some research that elders here had conducted. There were also adults there, but because of perceptions towards the indigenous community, the tribes of the area of being childlike, we see them also being lumped in as, you know, these students at the school, particularly these 2 years. And through some research, we have a list of some of the names of the people there and share two paths of at least two people. One is a student who in Jason Lee's journal is Sam or Samuel. He, Reverend Jason Lee, doesn't like him and is rather disparaging in his journal about this student who was young, probably maybe early teens by 44. And he goes through this experience for several years. He, as we know from that auditor, the outside reviewer that closes this facility, that this is not living up to its mission. It is not a good place, that we see later that this student goes on and becomes a person that we know in the Southern Valleys as Chief Sam, and Chief Sam of Sam's Valley outside of Table Rocks. And later in conflict with the federal government. But as a student, he's learned English. He ostensibly knew French and several tribal languages as well, and emerges through that as a leader of his people. Wow. Another person that also a contemporary in that same time period was Chief Shemgreta. He's same age as Chief Sam. He goes through the same experience as a child and later emerges as the first, you know, police officer, Grand Ronde police officer at the reservation, and then becomes the chief of tribal police, and then becomes the lead judge of the tribe for tribal government. So he has also learned English and had French and spoke multiple languages and emerges through a different path as a leader of his community as well.
And in just the last couple minutes we have left, can you tell us, I know you guys just finished the project there, did you find some artifacts or some archaeological signatures that are going to help you, you know, dig into this story a little bit further, or, you know, to kind of add this material cultural element to this documentary history that you were just sharing with us?
I can speak to that. Yes. So I get very excited about transfer print because that helps us to date and confirm that the features that we're finding are from that historic period. So within that cobble floor I mentioned, we found I haven't counted everything yet, 20 to 30 fragments of this transfer print that we had also found at the Jason Lee site and the Parsonage site, which tells us, it confirms that this was where the Methodists were. We have found fragments of slate, which, you know, they were using at the school. We have found very little with regards to indigenous material culture, other than, you know, my favorite thing was a pig skull, and that was found below the burn layer and then below the foundation layer of the floor. So again, with understanding stratigraphy, it's pretty old. So I don't know. It's hard to date something like that or confirm the use, but definitely these lands were used for thousands of years prior to occupation by the Methodists. So we are going to be coming back next year to do some additional investigations and hope to continue our collaborative efforts with the Grand Ronde and better understand this period of contact.
That's awesome. I look forward to keeping an eye on your research and learning more. So that wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more at jeffexchange.org or wherever you get your podcasts.